you start to collect your loves, because when the Kanye West of your life comes for you, and you'll be like, do you want to trade lives with me? And you're like, I don't know. It looks pretty awkward with you and Kim in Wyoming. I kind of do. You would have to give up all of your loves. And if you collect enough, you'll be like, no, I don't want to give it up. Look how much I've been given. I've been given so, so much.
Welcome to the We Collide podcast. We're a growing community of everyday chicks colliding with Jesus in our mess, our pain, our joy, and our stories. We value showing up as we truly are, so that's what you'll find here. Walls and masks being torn down so that we can allow Jesus to meet us where we truly are and hear about other women doing the same. We can't wait to collide with you.
Welcome to the We Collide podcast. This is Willow Weston, the founder and director of Collide, and I'm so glad that you hopped on today. We have a special gift for you. We had Scott Erickson, who's a touring painter, a performance speaker, and a creative curator, come up and use his passion and his work to invest in the women at our last Collide conference. And we were looking at the parable of the talents, and he really wanted to lean into the work he's been doing around social media and how it's affecting our lives and causing envy and depression. And comparison. And when you read the parable of the talents, it's a story of this master who handed out all of these talents to his servants, and they each got differing amounts. And so often Scott talked about how we compare our lives to other people's lives on social media, and we live in this time where it's sort of taking over. And he really leaned into the idea of giving ourselves the gift of us and not giving up on ourselves. And I loved what he had to say at this event, so much so that we wanted to let those of you who couldn't make it be able to hear it. And those of you who could, that you could hear it again and share it with those you think need to hear it. So I'm going to press play on that, and know that oftentimes when you hear laughter, he points to something, he shows all sorts of pictures and paintings in his talk. And you won't be able to see that obviously on the podcast, but you'll completely track with what he has to say. And I'm 100% sure that you'll be blessed by it. So here you go.
Thank you. Oh, man. Hello, everybody. I'm so honored to be here. One, this is a women's conference, and I'm not. But I've been four times. I get a jacket next year. Really honored to be here, and so honored. I don't really have words for it. Just, I'm really humbled to be up here. This space, if I was to talk about some of the spaces that have been the most influential in my life, this room is one of those. I met Willow here. I sat in a pew back there my sophomore year of college thinking about where I was going to go, and it was Western, and I visited the Inn. And some of my best friends that I still have, I met in this room. I did counseling for the first time up in that room. One of my most embarrassing experiences happened right down there, which Jocelyn and I just worked out. So I've been freed from it. I've been thinking about it for 20 years. So I've had some healing tonight. Hallelujah. Anyways, so I'm honored to be here sharing. Yeah, and I do have a book. Look, I don't know if we like the author who talks about their book, but let's just go there. I do want to say this, because it's a part about what I'm going to talk about tonight, is that prayer is not getting God's attention. That's voodoo. Prayer is awakening to the work and voice of God in your life already. And listening to the voice of God is listening to the voice of love, and I don't know if I'll filled up on that. And so I want to talk about tonight, so this book is a tool to help get to that voice, and there's some downstairs, but I want to get to what is the voice of God in our lives now, and maybe why. And so we're going to go on a weird, strange conversation to get there, if that's cool with you. So, I went to college at Western, and people I met in this room, I lived with four guys in a house. We graduated, we're all married, we have kids. There's more kids than there are adults now. And we get together multiple times a year and hang out. But every year in January, we rent a cabin in Port Townsend, and we get our kids in together. We like cook together, go on hikes together, play together. And on Saturday night, we cook a meal together. We take all the tables and make one long table, and we ask ourselves these two questions. We say, what was your best moment of the year, and what was your worst moment of the year? This particular year, my best moment of the year was taking my kids to Disneyland, which is so cliche, I know. My kids are much older. They were young here. Look, I think as a parent, you'd like to think that your kids' best memories are getting out in the backyard, camping with mom and dad, Thursday night dinners. There's no way this billion-dollar company is going to let those memories go to you. It's going to be at their theme parks with their characters, and it's amazing. You should go. Maybe you've gone as an adult, and you're like, I don't know. It's okay. There's lots of strollers around. That's true. But when you go with little kids, it's magical. Like, it was so wonderful. I was depressed for 3 days after we left. So I have three kids now. Those two are now 8 and 6, and we have a one-year-old. He just turned one, and I have a baby in my 40s. That's why I look like a tired newsie. You know what I'm saying? Like we're sleep training right now, and it's like torturing your child in another room while you're trying to sleep. You can't do it. Anyways, I haven't slept. That's all I'm saying. Okay, what was your worst moment of the year? Particular year involved this. Now, it wasn't had to do with my bowels, but my wife and I lived in this weird house. It was like weird, quirky house, and I put our kids to bed, and I walked out into the living room, and I realized that I was crying. Not because we had a mad, but something else. And I tried to stop. I couldn't stop crying, and it got deeper and deeper, and I made my way into the only bathroom in the house, which was right off the kitchen, and I sat on this toilet, and I cried for an hour. And my wife came in and asked me, like, are you okay? Do you want to talk about it? And I was like, my tears are me talking about it. I really don't know what this is. And after some time and listening, I realized what was happening to me is that a dream was dying. That there had been some kind for a long, long time. And psychologically and physically, my body knew that it wasn't going to come true. And it was mourning and grieving the loss of that dream. And I can tell you what that is a little bit later on. But as we go into this, like, what is a dream? You know, because when we use that word, a dream can mean lots of different things. It can mean, you know, a series of images in your head as you're going to sleep, or a house on a street of dreams, or some kind of object or thing you'd like to get. Or simply, when I just say dream, a lot of you just think Ryan Gosling, because that guy is a dream. Or maybe he appears in your dreams. Some of you are like, I don't know why. I like that he's my dad in this one. I don't. If there's any therapists that want to help me figure that out, that's great. But if you were to look in the dictionary, the definition for a dream is a cherished desire. Uh-oh, I just used a sexy word. Desire did something. Desire means you want something. And look, I'm not a psychologist or an anthropologist or any kind of gist. I think, though, what we want isn't necessarily a thing, but we'd like to be a certain kind of person when we got that thing. And I think generationally, we've been pitched different ways to get there. Like my parents' generation, I really think they got pitched kind of this materialism, this money after the war, this, you know, get the house, get in the burbs, get the car, get the new kitchen, get the color TV, all this kind of up and standing citizen you'd like to be. I mean, who are all these RVs for anyways? And look, my generation, I come from the end of Generation X. We saw our parents get divorced and be miserable, so we knew that didn't work. But we were living these kind of plain lives. Sometime in our boring lives, this outside force, something alien, is going to come into our boring lives and take us on the adventure that we'd all like to have, right? It's not here, it's somewhere else. Who's trying to take us to space right now, okay? And then, for those of you who are younger than me, you're really screwed, because what you were told time and time again is that the place that you are going to find your real self was going to be on a stand, because that lasts forever, right? And yeah, you might find a certain part of yourself on stage. You might also find a part of yourself that you weren't ready for either. I loaned her that. And then What happens, though, is that never comes true. Because a dream often is something we've adopted when we were younger and we saw it in somebody else and we can never become somebody else. And so that dream is. And this is when the voice of giving up comes to us. And I like to talk about the voice of giving up because I've had long conversations with the voice of giving up. And it's got very convincing conversations. But let's give it some skin because it's when we start talking about these voices, they're very ethereal. We're like, what is it? So I would like to give it some skin through the filter of Jurassic Park 2, The Lost World. Now, stick with me here. Jurassic Park, fantastic film. Michael Crichton wrote it. Steven Spielberg directed it. It was great. Made a lot of money. And then, like, let's not as good of a film. I wasn't at the production meeting for Jurassic Park 2, The Lost World. But I bet they're like, okay, there was dinosaurs eating people on an island. How do we get to dinosaurs eating people in Southern California? That's the film. And look, Steven Spielberg has given us a lot of amazing cinematic moments in our lifetimes. But what he does with this is garbage, and we should not let him get away with it. Okay. So there's a tarantula around San Diego, and he's thirsty. There's a swimming pool. Here's what the voice of giving up is like. You're in your bed, and you're like, I have this idea. You know what? I'm going to start tomorrow. I would like to do this thing. Yeah. The overwhelming presence comes into your room, looks straight into your soul, and goes, give up. That's what the voice of giving up is like. So for the rest of tonight, let's just call it the Tyrannosaurus Rex of giving up. Now, I've listened to the T-Rex of giving up. It's got very, very convincing arguments. And if I was to ask you all what you've heard, we'd probably say similar things. If I was to sum up what it says to me the most, here's a few things it says to me. Nothing's going to change. This same miserable moment that you're in, this is going to be the rest. This is going to be every day for the rest of your life. And thinking about doing that just makes me don't want to do it. The second thing it says to me, it says, you suck and are ugly. It gets really personal for some reason. Like, knocks you to the ground, kicks you while you're down there. But what it's saying is, like, there's some place of success you would like to get to, and there's something that's holding you back that's going to prevent you from getting there. In fact, there's something you can't change that's always going to keep you from getting there. And then the last thing it says to me, it says, dying is better than living. And look, if we're going to start talking about dying, we need to understand that dying is on a spectrum. Because you can binge watch something every single night and not deal with the conversation you know you need to have. You can open a bottle or tap your phone endlessly to numb the pain that keeps calling your name that you don't want to talk to. And yeah, you can go all the way to the end of even want to be here anymore. And look, if I show this spectrum, we maybe all know somebody who's gone through one of these things and come on the other side and said there's nothing for us there. Like, I had a friend who was addicted to video games and it was ruining his marriage. And he's like, I'm fine, whatever, my wife's just crazy. And he was like, his wife went to bed, he was playing, he's like, I'm just gonna play for a bit. He played for a bit, and then he noticed when he looked out his window, the sun was coming up. He had played all night long, and he realized he had a problem, and he picked up his Xbox, and he went and he smashed it in pieces. And he's like, and I went and got help, right? So I have a friend who went through this kind of dying, and came out and said, guess what, there's nothing for you there. It was just distraction. And we might know somebody, or even we are somebody in this room who's gone through one of these. Know if any of us know anybody who's gone all the way and been able to come back and tell us that there's nothing for us there. If there is any people in this world at all. But there are some. So since the creation of the Golden Gate Bridge, about 2,000 people have jumped off to take their own lives. And right now, there's 19 living survivors. One guy named Kevin Hines, look, he had a tough upbringing. He was orphaned, a lot of undiagnosed mental issues. Tough spot. But he came to this conclusion that being here wasn't worth it. And so he went to this bridge, and he jumped off. And he had this experience on the way to the ocean that we'll come back to in a second. Hit the water, he lived. The Coast Guard picked him up, and they're like, you don't understand, you're a miracle. You don't know how many bodies we pull out of here weekly. None of them are alive. And it took him a long time to heal. He broke multiple bones. It took months and months in the hospital. But when he went and found the 18 other living survivors and asked them about their experience going down, and they all had the same experience, which he sums up in his own words by saying this: the millisecond my hands left the rail, it was an instant regret. Everything that I thought was completely, like, unchangeable was completely changeable. The only thing that was unchangeable was falling to the ocean. So could we make Kevin our friend on a conversation about like giving up, like totally giving up? Can we make Kevin our friend to say there we know somebody who's gone all the way and said, look, that's still not the answer. But what do you do when your dreams die? Because to dream is to desire, and to desire is to want, and to want is to want to be here. And if you don't want to be here, then being here is really hard. See, now this is the place that often religion plays. And religion has a really great pitch. It says this. It says, hey, you have this hole in your life, and you keep trying to fill it with the, you know, the drugs and the rock and roll rectangle, and it doesn't fit. Or you keep trying to love fame and popularity and Instagram likes, you know, whatever it is, and it doesn't fit. And you need to get the circle of God and put it in there, and that will complete you. And we make God a product. And the problem is when you make anything a product, the moment that product doesn't work, you leave it. This toothpaste didn't clean my teeth. This weed killer didn't kill my weeds. This God let my dreams die. And you walk away. The other problem with that presupposes that the giver of your existence hasn't already been involved with your life already. What if the giver of your existence is the one that actually lets you to get to a place where that dream could die, because the dream was the thing in the way to the deeper conversation? A long time ago, a guy named St. Ignatius of Loyola, he's dead now, he was a really feisty guy. A lot of battles in the 1500s. He was Spanish. They were fighting the French. He was doing his thing, hit in the leg with a cannonball, like you do, and he got injured, and he spent a year in a hospital healing up, and they had not a great library. All they had was the Bible and stories of the saints, and he read them, and he had this transformational experience, so transformational that after a year of healing, he took his armor and his sword and all of his wealth, and he went to the nearest monastery, and he laid it at the feet of the monks, and he's saying, my ways as a warrior, I want to spend the rest of my life serving God. This is the man who founded the Jesuits, if you've ever heard of them. He also developed this thing called spiritual practices. And he said, the way that the giver of your existence speaks the loudest about your life is actually through your desires. But that takes discernment. Because our desires can lead us to a place of flourishing. They can also lead us to a place of destruction. We've all seen somebody who desires led to a place of generosity and fulfilledness and fullness and flourishing, the best version of themselves. And we've also seen that same desire lead a person to like greed and closed offness in this like destructive person. They might desire one another physically, relationally, emotionally, sexually, and they need to discern if they're being invited into what it takes to accomplish the vocation of a relationship. You might have a desire for some kind of occupation, and you need to discern whether or not you're being invited to the conversation of like the skills and the commitment it's going to take to accomplish that vocation. I found that my dream was dying, but there was still this like desire there. And I wondered, T-Rex of giving up, and I was like, why are you saying these things? Maybe these are the actual doorways that I need to walk through. Because why would you be standing in the way like this? And so I started walking through them and started developing these spiritual practices to deal with these voices. And I just want to tell you about one, because I think it's really important and on the theme that we're talking about tonight. And we're going to talk about the one where it says, you suck and are ugly. My favorite. So, to talk about this, we need to reference like a weird story in the Bible, okay? Which there's plenty to choose from. This one particular, this is in the Old Testament, the Ark of the Covenant. You remember it, you know, the one that melted all the Nazis' faces off in Raiders of the Lost Ark? Ah, that's how we won the war. And it goes missing. There's a lot of blood there. It goes missing. And they can't find it. And then somebody stole it. And then they do. And they get it back. And they're bringing it back into Jerusalem. And it says that King David is like dancing with all his might. It says that he's wearing a linen ephod, which in the Old Testament, that means tidy whities. And he's just out there dancing with all his might. And then it says this. It says, when the ark of the Lord was entering the city, Michal, daughter of Saul, this is David's wife, watching from a window, when she saw the king leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. So here's the situation. The Ark of the Covenant, the commitment and the covenant with Yahweh, the creator of all things, the giver of existence, a symbol of existing itself, is coming into their midst. And there is a person there who knows how to dance in front of existence, and there's surprising those who figured out how to dance. How do we become people in our lives who know how to dance in existence? And how do we become people who despise those who figured out how to dance? So we should talk about superheroes just for a second. Have you seen the latest superhero movie? Yeah, right? I did too. Do you notice I don't even have to give a title? Because we're in this crazy time where Hollywood figured out how to make billions off a comic book, so there's just this onslaught of superhero movies. Like, and it's great, I love it. But I was reading a book to my son the other night, and a centaur was in it, and he's like, what's a centaur? And I was like, well, it's kind of like, you know, it's like an ancient superhero. They didn't think about laser beams coming out of their eyes or cutlery out of their hands. They just was like, what's big and powerful in the world? Horses, let's be half of that, right? And that's how they made superheroes. But I was like, buddy, I don't know like what outfits they wore, because, you know, I know horses wear clothes and superheroes wear clothes, but I'm not quite sure like how a centaur wore clothes, because maybe they don't need it, but you're like, I don't know, maybe it's four. Two makes sense. One, three is just like an apron, though. I don't get it. And so, there you go. You think you get it, and then you're like, wait, but maybe it's that one. I don't know. I think when we actually talk about superheroes and invent superheroes, what we're really hoping is that we actually believe we need to be more, right? When we're imagining like the path of success we would like to get to, and we go, okay, I'm going to start on that, we instantly go, I don't actually think I have what it takes to get there. Like, I'm not smart enough or good-looking enough or talented enough. I don't have enough skills. I didn't come from the right family. My brain doesn't work right. My body doesn't work right. Whatever, all of these things, we start making these lists. Like, I can just simply ask you, like, what's your least favorite aspect of your list that we make up? And so we dismiss ourselves from that. And we're like, I don't think I actually get there. But we notice that other people are on their way there. And we're like, I see you going there. How did you get there? Maybe I need to start, right? And we begin to compare ourselves. We begin to compare ourselves to people who are going on a route that's calling our name. But we're like, I want to go on their route. And look, I've had a secret comparison for years. And he's like not had a great couple years. And I've kind of been freed from this comparison, which is great. But I'm going to admit to you my, like, secret comparison for a long time. And that was with Kanye West, obviously, because we have a lot in common. Met Kanye West one time backstage at the Sasquatch Festival. This is years ago. He had just gotten done doing his graduation set, which is a great album. And I was there in, like, the beer garden, and he was coming out in his white suit. And I was like, yeah, people are taking pictures. I was like, yeah, I want one too. And we got a picture. He was as excited as I was. And then that was it. That was it. That's the only time we've ever met. But I found out later on that Kanye and I are the same age. We're just like, our birthdays are a couple months apart. By number alone, when my life wasn't going well and I was like, this isn't working, I go, who else is trying to do what I'm doing? And I would look to Kanye. And I would say, he's very fashionable. He's very comfortable in his own clothes. Like, he's got his own fashion line, his shoe line. He has a lot of confidence in, like, what he wears, and you can see that, right? This is probably, like, the most confidence I've ever felt in an outfit. Can tell by my power stance, you know? Hey. Kanye's a performer. He sells out stadiums worldwide. I do some performing, and here's, like, the six people that came to my show in Minnesota not too long ago. He says things on television and media. He's affecting culture. We're talking about Kanye now, right? He's a celebrity. And look, I was on TV one time, and I don't know how much, like, culture it affected, but it affected. Look, I was on The Price is Right. It actually happened while I was here at Western. And look, it was cool in 1999 to have bleached hair, and that's not a puka shell necklace. It's a hemp necklace made by a girl that I was into at the inn, okay? And so, yeah, I've lived all your fantasies, okay? I was with Bob Barker. I played for a car. I did it all. It was amazing. It was a great time. It was really fun. But here's the thing. So maybe I beat Kanye. Yeah, I spun the wheel. Guys, I got a 90 on my first spin. And I was like, I'm going to stay. And then I looked at Alan, my friend Alan in the audience. I was like, 90? Yeah, that was great. Okay. So maybe I beat Kanye there. But what we do is we compare ourselves, right? And look, social media makes it so easy to do comparison. And I'm not here to poo-hoo social media. I know a lot of you know my work because of social media, and I have kind of had a career kind of off of it. Here's where it goes wrong, though. Because it does go wrong. I'd like to point out here's where it goes wrong. So look, say you want to get married, all right? And a wedding is a crazy thing to put together. It's crazy, especially now. Because if you're like, I need some ideas, and you go on Pinterest, and you type in wedding ideas, and then this like of just like bridesmaids dresses and color schemes and table settings and lace and flower arrangements, and you're like, oh my gosh, and you make these like lists and stuff, and you're like, it's gonna be the perfect day, it's gonna be the most wonderful day, and you bring it all together and you're ready to nail it, and guess what? It's a little humid that day, and nothing's really flowing, it's just all kind of in there. Yeah. Or say you want to be a better cook. You're like, I don't need to make Thanksgiving for everybody. How about just some cornbread and hot dogs? How hard can that be? Turns out, not that easy. Right? There's a show on Netflix called Nailed It. It's in season 2. It's so common. Or say you want to try all these people traveling. There's some in some exotic land, finding themselves, having adventures. They're usually wearing a fedora. I want to do that. I want to go on an adventure. I want to own a fedora. And so you save your money up, and you make all your plans, you buy your tickets, and you get there. Everybody else had the same idea. If you've ever traveled, you know it's never empty. There's always somebody there, right? So what happens is that we try to take the very crowded, smelly, burnt, sweaty, normal reality of our lives, and we try to bring it into this curated reality that is unaccomplishable. And now we are allowed to do that every single day. Compare ourselves. Do that enough, you start to go, there's actually no place to be me in the world. There's no place for me to find any kind of success by being me. And then when you get to this spot, this is a deeply spiritual conversation. This is a spiritual conversation. This is a painting of St. Peter and St. John. They're executed. 3 days later, another friend goes to the tomb. It's empty. She runs back, tells them they're going to see if it's true or not. We just celebrated this. John, he wrote a few books in the Bible, all bestsellers, makes amazing royalty checks. And he talks about his experiences with Jesus. I don't know if you've read them. He talks about himself in third person, and he gives kind of an interesting take as him as a character. I know that all of you, because you're really wonderful, big-hearted about your experiences of Jesus, you'd be like, and I humbly was there, partaking in all the wonderful things that God was giving to us, right? John kind of does that, but he goes, yeah, and the disciple who Jesus loved, that's me. That's how he describes himself in his own book. He wrote that about himself. We'll come back to that for a second. Peter, we don't have time for an exegetical Bible study. You're welcome. But Peter, you might know the story. He's really in for it. There's this denial, this crucifixion, the resurrection, some weird stuff, a miracle, a breakfast on a beach, and then a conversation, do you love me? These three questions. Jesus is asking him. He's bringing those three denials, bringing him back into relationship. And if you've ever had a friend that you've harmed or hurt reach out to you and reconcile between you, you know that the way you respond after that conversation is to go, oh, man. Thanks, Jesus. Like, that was really eating me up inside. I just can't stop thinking about it, and I feel so bad, but I feel like we're good now. Thank you for doing this. Like, I'm ready to go. Let's build this thing, right? Normal response. That's not what he says, though. That's not what he says after their conversation. This, written by John, is what he says. Then Jesus says to Peter, follow me. And Peter turned and saw that the disciple whom Jesus loved, he wrote that about himself, was following them. And when Peter saw him, he said, Lord, what about him? What about him? I want him to remain alive until I return. What's that to you? You must follow me. Look, it took me a really long time to understand that you can be a follower of good news and be the kind of follower that's like, I love this. This is great. Hallelujah. What about them? I mean, glory, hallelujah, Maranatha. I'm really into this. But do you like them more than me? Because their life looks awesome. And honestly, like, my life sucks. And as far as I can tell, like, we're doing the exact same thing. And then you can also be a follower of good news and go, oh, I get it. I get what this is about. I'm the one that's loved. I'm the beloved. You can't receive love if you secretly hate who love's made you to be. Because love wants to pour itself out into you. And this is the container you've been given to receive that love. And if all you're doing all the time is trying to switch it out, then that love falls flat. I ended up at this charismatic meeting one time. Look, I grew up Lutheran. Like, we never talked about the Holy Spirit. It was like a bad uncle who doesn't come to Thanksgiving anymore. And if you've ever been to a charismatic meeting, it's very exciting. Greens and flags and jazz hands. It's great. It's great. I wasn't doing any of that. I was sitting in, like, the back row. Just, oh, it's great. I'm just here to watch. Then, you know, do your thing. And I noticed in the back corner, in the dark, a man who I can only describe as like a chubby Dwight Schrute from The Office, just doing pirouettes to the Lord. Like, it was hilarious. It was like watching travel guide Rick Steves' tryout dance, you know? And I was laughing so hard. Look, I'm not a monster. I was laughing inwardly, not outwardly. Because it's hilarious watching a chunky middle-aged man do moves that five-year-olds do at ballet class. It's funny. And look, he wasn't a stage person, because we've all seen stage people do stage things, and you're like, that's a stage person. It's the people in the back corner, in the dark, who really believe what they're doing. And I was watching this guy laughing, and then I, just after a while, I stopped laughing, and I watched him, and I found that I got jealous. And I was like, how did you figure out how to be so comfortable in your own skin? Because I actually want to dance. I don't want to stand on the side and despise those who figured out how to dance. Friends, like, crazy time, more than any other human beings ever, in this crazy culture of comparison. And, like, stats are coming out now through psychologists and therapists, neurologists, that saying, like, this stuff is, like, making us more anxious and depressed, wanting to kill ourselves. And we're privy to it because of technology, and we need to have all those conversations. But we also need to figure out a spiritual practice to live in this world. A spiritual practice that lets us connect with God and the identity and the love that God gives us. And I started doing one, and it's actually really simple. And it just goes like this. We got to move from comparison to contribution. What comparison is trying to become somebody else and get in their lane of success. Because guess what? You do suck. You suck at being somebody else. Then what contribution is the slow daily uncovering of the secret path of desire that God, the giver of your existence, has put inside you to walk. And slow daily practice of honoring and seeing that. Have you ever had that experience? And you're like, I don't know, I feel like I'm on some kind of path. But in the moment, you're like, I don't know what's next. In the future, you're like, no idea, right? We kind of know. Contribution is that daily practice of uncovering that hidden path of desire that's been given to you to walk. And when I say contribution, I don't mean making products, although that might be the evidence of the work you're doing. But contribution is simply your love catalyzed. What do you love and why? What do you love and why? We all do. Because pizza is like bread, cheese, and sauce cake. And you eat it and you put it inside of you and light emerges. You become like an Italian Care Bear and you're Care Bear staring everybody with joy. Like, have you had this? Awesome! It's amazing. And that's why we eat it together. Or by ourselves in our hotel room. I love pizza, though, because my pizza parlor, where my brother and I would play Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles at the arcade, and then we'd sit and eat together as a family. Eating pizza reminds me that I come from a family that loves me. Do you understand this is the plot of Ratatouille? Like, it's so simple. But we have another word for what we love and why. And that word is gratitude. Gratitude is what you love and why. And look, it's been proven by therapists and psychologists that if you were to simply write down three what you loves and why every day, say in a gratitude journal at the end of the day, that it would improve your mental health, your physical health, it would improve your sleeping habits. But the other thing that it does is that you start to collect your loves. You start to collect your loves because when the Kanye West of your life comes for you, and it will, and you'll be like, do you want to trade lives with me? And you're like, I don't know. It looks pretty awesome with you and Kim in Wyoming. I kind of do. You would have to give up all of your loves. And if you collect enough of what your loves, if you collect enough of them, you'll be like, no, I don't want to give it up. Look how much I've been given. I've been given so, so much. Oh, there's music for this. There it is. Yeah. I love this song by PM Dawn, Hook by Human League. I love it because it reminds me of my junior high crush, Lynn Marth, which never amounted to anything. I love the feeling because to deeply love something is the best feeling of all. Because to love is to desire, and to desire is to want to be here. And this song reminds me of what a joy it is to be here. My favorite smell is low tide. I grew up in Mukilteo, so the smell of decaying seaweed was always around. And low tide is magical because it reveals a world that is mostly hidden. Look around the tide pools and scattered kelp beds and witness that hidden world is to remember that what we see is not all that there is. I love rolled up socks. I love plastic sandwich bags with or without sandwiches in them. I love a good rainstorm. I love the way my body feels after a long swim. I love my body. Well, look, I'm trying to. Like, I've been programmed to see it as not good enough for so long, mostly in Speedo situations, that I forget what a joy it is to be in a biological masterpiece. And I actually remember this the most when I hug my kids. I remember when my daughter was a little baby and we were laying on the bed together, and I heard the voice of God tell me that she was going to be a gift to the world. And like when God tells you a secret, you don't ever forget it. I love church. Look, not necessarily what we've made it in America. Like there's a lot of fluff that can go away. But I love what happens to my eyes and my ears and my heart when I'm in. The poet Rilke has a poem that says, "Where are we going on this glorious journey?" To your house, of course. And I believe this poem the most when we gather in its holy name. I love you, giver of existence. Even though I have some deep questions about your invisibility and the suffering of this world and the absurdity of salmon migration, like I see that you have given us the gift of existing. And admittingly, it's trying at times. Like there's so much loss. But what a gift to receive and what a world to love and a cup to drink deeply from. So thank you for my life, this one, with its dad tummy and its creaky 40-year-old knees and its proclivity to melancholiness, Enneagram 4, if you know what that means. I'm glad to be alive. And we as your people, we want to dance in your presence. So come and dance with me. Not because it's a religious thing to do, but it's something that lovers can't be. Amen? Amen. Let me pray for you. Yeah, I get it. Giver of our existence, I'm so honored to be in the midst of some of the best part of existence, these wonderful women. Thank you for their conversations and their hearts and their desires and all of those things that you're working your kingdom in this world. I pray that they would hear the voice and all of the exciting things, mundane things, simple things, and they would realize that that you're inviting them to walk a path that you've already laid for them to have. In your name, amen.
Man, every time I get to hear Scott Erickson speak or see him paint or sit in a conversation with him, I am enriched. I feel like I grow in my idea of who God is. I'm challenged to rethink the things that I have thought before about my faith and about Jesus, and I'm given hope to not give up on myself. And that has been such a gift to me that Scott's given me, and I hope you are given that gift today. We'll catch you next week on the podcast. In the meantime, if you feel like this message from Scott would bless someone, go ahead and share it. And if you love the We Collide podcast and you want to go up and give us a great review, just that small little act will help us to grow our reach to invite more people to collide with Jesus. Thanks for joining us today. We'll catch you next week.